This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
Welcome to Return to the Pine Trees, a selection of six short stories for radio broadcast about growing up in the North Dublin areas of Turnipin Lane, Clunshock, Old Coolock Lane, Clochran and the village of Santry. These stories take place between 1965 and 1970 and they bring to life a time in these respective areas on the outskirts of Dublin city before it all changed forever. These areas weren't on their own when the changes came. There were many other small townlands and villages all around Dublin, both north and south, overwhelmed by a quickly expanding city. Unfortunately for my particular area, Turnipin Lane, which is just past Santry heading north towards Dublin Airport, change came from all sides. The city to the south, Dublin Airport to the north, and the M50 and M1 to the east. The airport in particular, which is only a mile away from Turnipin Lane, was a huge influence on the way things would go. I bring these stories to you, the listeners of Near FM Radio, hoping they are enjoyable to listen to and also to provide you a social record of what was happening on the outskirts of North Dublin in the late 1960s and the early 1970s. Some events have been combined to create a good narrative. In some cases, I go into a lot of detail, especially on my journeys from place to place and the people I meet along the way. This is the social document side of things. Music is very important to the stories, and in particular, Gilbert O'Sullivan, our Irish-born singer and songwriter. His songs always resonated a certain innocence, which is exactly what I want to convey in my stories. I hope they will act as triggers and transport you right into the very heart of the stories. Please join me on my journeys, and I hope you will enjoy the stories for what they are, stories about youth and growing up. I've decided to use my own voice and added some gentle sound effects as part of this radio book project, which gives the stories a little bit of depth, especially in the narrative. The name of this story is entitled The Ghosts of Christmas Past, and it is the second story in our series of six. Everyone has their very own first Christmas morning memory, and mine was at the age of 5 getting a blue tricycle while my younger brother Noel got a red one. The way the Christmas tree lights and tinsel sparkled and shimmered as they reflected in the chrome of the two tricycles has stayed with me to this day.
Just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops.
As the years passed and I got older, I would sometimes slide underneath our tree on my back and gaze up at the horse and carriage lights as they cast colourful, cosy light here and there. I would think to myself that I would happily live on a Christmas tree if I could. We were living in Grove Park Avenue at the time, and it would be the last time that I would creep down the stairs of a Christmas morning. By the following year, we were living in number 21 Turnipin Lane, which was a single-storey cottage and had no stairs. Out to the back of 21 Turnipin Lane was our small coal yard, and at Christmas time it was very busy and the pace was hectic, but what a great place it was to be at that time of year. These were dark and cold, frosty mornings, with lorry engines starting up and left ticking over while the last minute cups of hot tea were dispensed by my long-suffering mother. The lorry sat waiting, stacked to the hilt with coal, their headlights peering like two twinkling eyes in the blackness. In the big shed, there were big overcoats airing on the glowing pot-bellied stove as my uncles moved around the lorries and steering directions were shouted out in the misty, fume-laden morning air. We lay half awake getting ready to rise for school, hearing in the distance, "Hard on your left! Hard on your left! Whoa-hoo! Just on a little bit! Grand! That'll do you!" Back then, when the weather closed in and it got really cold, coal merchants like ourselves literally kept people alive, especially the older people. In the 1960s, the coal business was very much part of the shopping frenzy that was Christmas, with everyone making sure they were kept warm with plenty of coal and logs and turf piled up out in people's coal houses. To this day, I still meet people who tell me that the coolies always threw in the coal and no one was ever left cold for the sake of money. At Christmas time, all five coolie lorries were flat out. We had three tipper lorries drying coal the short distance from the boats to the city quay coal yards of Doherty's, Donnelly's and Tedcastle's. One of these lorries, driven by my father, was a big blue Ford with an aluminium body that would later become our Batman and Robin den. A certain Mr. Kenny seemed to be an important man on the end of our phone in the freezing cold hall beside my bedroom. Dad would be answering. "Yes, Mr. Kenny." "Oh no, Mr. Kenny." "Oh, that's no problem, Mr. Kenny. You won't have to worry about that, Mr. Kenny." "Ah, that's grand, Mr. Kenny." Sometimes I'd be out under my breath, "Three bags full, Mr. Kenny." He worked for Donnelly's coal firm, and by all accounts he was a very fair man, who gave out the work for the coolies' coal trucks. His first name was Tommy, but he was always called Mr. Kenny. Mr. Walsh was the Tedcastle's man, and the tune was the same. "Yes, Mr. Walsh." "No, Mr. Walsh. Three bags full, Mr. Walsh." The other two smaller lorries were the Bell lorries, which delivered coal far and wide out into North County Dublin. The name Bell is used because in the old days, the horse-drawn coal cart would have a bell which rang out to let people know the coal man was around. This saved knocking on every door, or making little of yourself, as my dad would say. They know we're here, and if they want coal off us, they'll be out. Coal was a cash business, so there was always plenty of Christmas boxes flying in our direction as we went out helping during this time. My grandfather Bill Cooley always looked after us when he knew you were heading off on the big Christmas excursion into town. Yes, back then we referred to Dublin as just town. As well as going out on the delivery round, you would do a little bit in the coal yard, bagging some bags of coal and slack, using the screen to sift the slack off the coal. So we always made sure you got paid for your bit of work. In the early days of the Cooley family, it was a big day out into town to see Daddy Christmas, when you were dragged around the shops for the annual rig out while you were there. This was always a very fretful and traumatic affair, with at least one or two of us ending up half strangled in Cleary's midway through the expedition. To this day, I still remember some of these incidents, especially if I'm in a shop and it's very, very warm and I really, really have to get out of there. All of this stuff comes flooding back into my memory. These traumatic experiences are buried deep in my subconscious. Such was the brutality and stress of it all. My mother was the poor unfortunate Pied Piper, with her younger sister Chris giving her a dig out, if you pardon the pun. The word guzzle comes to mind and pretty much described these public chokings, and as the eldest, I got blamed for everything. Henry Street and Moore Street was a favourite of mine. Neon lights, crowds milling around, chaotic but really exciting. Ma did well to hold on to us all. "Get your wrapping paper here, son. Do you need a few batteries for your transistor radio?" were the calls from the buxom dealers, who always seemed bored to death with it all. Yet they had a little smile. They appeared friendly enough, but you knew behind that smile, you would cross them at your peril. Their accents were completely different to ours back in the country in Turnipin Lane. FX Buckley's in Moore Street had rows of yellow and purple turkeys hanging outside, heads dangling on the end of cold, long necks, with the blood dripping from their beaks onto the path below. I'd never walk under them. Couldn't, not if you paid me. The Del Rio Cafe in Malbra Street, facing the Abbey Theatre, was the usual finishing up spot for us exhausted, crying and sulking Christmas shoppers. Here is where we had our Christmas fish and chips. It was handy for us, as it was only around the corner from our 41A bus stop in Eden Quay. One Christmas, we all got too much for Mr. Del Rio's. He asked my mother to exercise some control over us. She duly grabbed us all together and told the bemused Mr. Del Rio what to do with his effing chip shop and left. Back to our very own Dublin Christmas safari, I had to be careful on bus journeys as I got travel sick very easily. And to be honest, I got absolutely zero sympathy for it. In fact, I do remember throwing up once on a bus only to get a belt around the ear from my mother for my troubles. "Making a show of me. What's wrong with you?" she rasped. I tried to explain, white-faced and coughing through the choking cauldron of fumes, tobacco smoke and vomit, but nobody was listening. I think my brother Noel secretly enjoyed my travel sickness problems. One Christmas, however, at the ripe old age of 11, my childhood died when I found out it was all just a big lie and there was no magic after all. I was totally and utterly devastated. There was no gentle transition, no explanation to soften the blow. There was no, "the spirit of Christmas is still real, son," from an indulgent parent, or an inventory of feelings, as the councillors say now. No, it was more like, "You're a bit hairy to be still believing in Santy." My mother had no time for niceties like that. My father was different. I seem to remember he was a bit heartbroken for me, and a little peeved that he was just told, "Gerard doesn't believe anymore." Now past that difficult age, I was promoted to chief toy buyer advisor for my younger brothers and sisters, and so I went into town with Dad in his car to help him. Ma was too busy to go. After all, she had 5 younger children to look after. Noel, who was 10, Linda, who was 9, David was 5, Karen was 4, and Stephen was 1. On this particular Christmas trip, it was a Sunday morning because Dad worked 6 days a week on the coal at Christmas time. We drove into town, and such was the crowd around the Dublin Woolen Mills corner, both of us ended up standing on the Halfpenny Bridge on the River Liffey. This was my very first view of the city from this angle. I loved it then, and I still love it today. While I stood on the bridge, seagulls swooped and cried all around us. Some landed on the ironwork of the bridge, and up close these birds were big and very aggressive, especially if you had anything in your hand that they fancied. From the bridge, I could see a man in the distance with grey hair, wearing a suit, shirt and tie, and dark-rimmed glasses. His name was Hector Gray. A small, bucky man with his grey hair slicked back. His real name was Mr. Scott, and ironically, he was from Scotland. The story was that he changed his name because his parents didn't approve on his Mr. Cheap approach to selling fancy goods, the very original Mr. Pound Shop. The name Hector Gray came from an Australian horse jockey, and Mr. Scott duly adopted it. This day, he was standing in the back of a big covered van in front of the Woolens Mill shop. He was roaring and shouting and laughing and throwing stuff out of the van. People were catching what he was throwing. Dad brought me closer, but I was too small now once we had left the bridge. He lifted me up, and then I saw that he was throwing toys at the people. There was mostly men in attendance, and they were shouting at him, waving their arms. A lot seemed drunk to me, all very noisy as they were shouting. "Hector, over here. I want 2 dolls, 1 black, 1 white." Hector shouted back, "What about a doll, a drum, and a kick up the bum and a chase around the table? Will that do you?" Dad asked me about Linda, my younger sister. She was 9, and I said, "Maybe a tea set, a doll, or a bunty annual." Till 5-year-old David got a cowboy hat, guns and holsters, and a rifle with real banging caps. On that Christmas morning, I remember Noel placing the barrel of this rifle in my ear and firing off the cap. Jesus, it hurt. It deafened me for ages. Ma nearly killed him. We left the hectic grey circus with armfuls of tyres, headed back to the car before heading on to some proper shops in around Liffey Street and Henry Street. Dad was generous, and if you wanted it, really, really wanted it, you got it. I got a Spirograph, and I think Noel got a Scalectric set. Noel was always interested in cars and lorries. He should have really been a mechanic like me Uncle Joseph. He did, however, go on to be, without doubt, the best lorry driver I have ever seen. He was very big for his age when he left school at 14, and he was driving one of the Bedford Bell lorries in and out of town with Grandad Cooley at his side. Back on the tyres front, Noel always wanted what I got, so the Scalectric set with the two cars was really between us. Thankfully, the cars were two different colours, just like our very first tricycles. Tea sets and nurses stuff for four-year-old youngest sister Karen. The youngest brother Stephen was only a tot at the time, just about walking. He got a Santee spaceship that spun when you wound it up. As well as that, he could play with and eat the other toys' discarded cardboard boxes. At some stage before we left the town, we stopped to pick up a turkey in a lane somewhere. Da later told me it was off Smithfield Market. Back on the home front when Christmas was getting closer, Ma would decide that a few rooms would need new wallpaper. The sitting room in particular was always being done because of the fire. Don't forget, at any one time, we would have at least 100 tons of loose coal heaped up around our yard at the back of the house. My grandfather Bill used to tease me mother, saying it was a race against her to see how much he could sell before she met him halfway through the heap as she was burning so much coal in the house. Our back boiler was always being replaced as it used to melt with the sheer heat. I've a great memory of Ma in the middle of one of her wallpapering runs. She used to wear these three-quarter length pink flowery smocks with the zip up the middle. She wore it all the time, and as she was a big woman, she was always bursting out of it. This time around, the sitting room was getting a last-minute pre-Christmas makeover. Nothing well planned, probably the day before the Christmas tree was going up. As usual, I was helping her. Da would always be the first to admit that DIY wasn't really his strong point. He had headed to Eugene O'Reilly's up in Santry with his sidekick Billy Pepper in tow, staying out of the way. I will paint the complete picture for you. Firstly, the coal fire was heaped up and red roaring and roasting. Everybody in the room was sweating. Six kids plus a dog and a blaring television. Linda was still in her school uniform, annoyingly hopping two small rubber balls off the sitting room walls. Archie balls, 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 king of the Jews, 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 brought his wife, 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 a pair of shoes, shoes, shoes. Then the shoes, shoes, shoes started to smell, smell, smell. Archie balls, 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 went to hell, hell, hell. She chanted this little ditty as she hopped the ball around the room. She knew Ma was out of range. Our dog Rover, a small mongrel collie, was chasing the hopping ball, and Ma was up on a table measuring the rolls of wallpaper. I had just painted one length on the freezing cold hall floor and had quickly run in so I could give her up the wet pasted paper. I then dived under the table, scissors in hand, holding the end to trim it off while Ma was trying to stick the pasted paper in place on the wall. The dog was still barking at Linda, and now it had strips of pasted paper sticking on its fore and on its paws. Ma cracked and shouted, "Will you get that effing dog out of here? I'm trying to concentrate. Now don't have me to get down to you." Linda paused and glared back at Ma through her pink Dame Edna Everage-styled glasses, but ignored her and continued hopping the ball around the barking dog. I still sweat a little when I go through this piece of the story. Underneath the table I cut the pasted paper, but it was wrong. Ma had gone low from the ceiling, so I cut it too short. As we tried to pull it back off the wall, the pasted embossed paper started to disintegrate in Ma's hands. At this point, Ma was moving into Dr. David Banner mode.
"Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Don't make me angry. You won't like me when I'm angry." Too late, Ma had lost it. I was still under the table, and then everything went into slow motion. I rolled out, bumped into the dog who was now standing motionless, staring up at Ma. The ball dropped from his gaping jaws, and I saw Ma reflected in his wide open eyes. I looked up from my shoulder from the paper and pasted covered floor and saw a 16-stone woman tottering on the brink of disaster. Her hair was in a ponytail tied to the top, and it too was wobbling as Ma tried to regain her balance, while threatening Linda with all sorts of physical violence when she would eventually get her hands on her. Meanwhile, Karen, Noel and David were sitting cross-legged on the floor, arguing over the television, blissfully unaware of the possible crushing heading their way. Out of nowhere, my Uncle Joseph, who was down in the kitchen making tea as usual, had heard the commotion and just in the nick of time saved us all as he jumped onto the shifting table. He grabbed Ma and steadied her back on. Linda had long since run, along with the dog, as Ma grabbed the swinging doors from the infamous hot press to finally steady her up. She stepped down to a chair beside the table. She was now safe, and thankfully, so were we. Work was cancelled immediately, and we headed down to the kitchen for a calming cup of tea. The next day we finished the room, but when Ma was wallpapering the hall the following day, she actually fell off the table while talking to Joseph, not watching what she was doing. Ma saw the funny side of it as poor Joseph tried to lift her up as she was jammed in the narrow hallway on the floor, between the table and the wall. Linda survived the incident, but the poor dog didn't. Poor Rover had a fit shortly afterwards. Oh, the stress of living with the coolies.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen. Of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I buy, may your day be merry and bright, and may all your Christmas
You've just been listening to myself, Jerry Cooley, narrating one of my short stories, The Ghosts of Christmas Past. Next week, I'll be reading another. I hope you'll join me.
Goodbye. you'd have changed. Long range, no change. Forget me now, you know how I will you. Will you please do? I've only this to say.
The program was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.